Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Profiling Evil Podcasts, Cults Among Us. Today, I'm talking with Benjamin Risha, a former member of the Tony and Susan Alamo religious cult. We're going to be talking about his life in the Alamo Christian Foundation and how the abuses that he endured nearly led him to murder. Let's talk Cults Among Us. Hey, Benjamin, thank you so much for joining today. Welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. Thanks for having me here.
It's my pleasure. And I'll tell you, I have to admit, I was riveted when I read your story and I watched the Discovery ID documentary where your life in the cult was dissected. I mean, you spent the first 17 years of your life in what you and many others describe as a destructive cult. And I say that and talk about how significant that is, because in my opinion, having looked at these kinds of organizations over the years, there are generational cults where children are raised in a belief system and ideology. Then there are these convert groups where people come in at older ages. And it's those children that are raised in the ideology that really suffer a whole lot more. What are your thoughts as we just get started with that just little question right there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I agree. The people who are like myself, who are first generation cult children or culties, however you want to call it, we don't have any other option. You know, we were born there and we endured what was done there, not knowing anything else. And we did it thinking, for the most part, that it was in the name of a really good cause, or because God said to do it, or it was a commandment or something to that effect. And yeah.
You know, and as you're talking, it made me wonder, do you have a faith tradition today? Were you able to maintain a belief in God or a God of some sort after going through an experience like that?
Initially, when I first got out and I, you know, when I was 17, I learned that I'd been lied to most of my life. I abandoned all faith, all religion, and I had to slowly sort of make my way back. And today, as I sit here today, I'm sort of like a multi-denominational, faith. Everyone's faith is often tied to their culture, tied to the geographic region that they happen to live in. So I'm of the belief that all roads sort of point to, if you're looking for it, will point to truth eventually. So I'm a Jewish, Buddhist, agnostic, Sufi. You know, I mean, I understand the Zoroastrians, and I look at all these faiths, and there's always beautiful stuff in a lot of them. You know, it's not the faith that's the problem; it's how people execute it. So, yeah, I do. I meditate. I've just started getting back into prayer, not necessarily to a God, but to an energy, if you will, a supernatural force that binds us all at the chemical level, at the and beyond. So it's a little different. It's not a traditional sort of, you know, way of being.
Of all of the child victims that were raised generationally, most have walked away from religion because of that fear or feeling of abandonment in a God that they believed in that somehow allowed all this wackiness to happen. But at age 17, you broke away and you beat the odds. And I'll tell you what, I really respect you for having the courage to talk about this, and also the courage to listen to that thing inside of you that said, even when you were raised in an ideology, that thing inside that kept saying, this isn't right, there's something wrong. And some people would call it the spirit, others would have different names for that. But all along, you had that growing inside and welling inside saying something was wrong. How would you describe that?
You did a spot on. It was a gradual coming to awareness, And it was by using the Bible that they taught us was the Word of God. It was by using the Bible to figure out what is true and not true. So if Tony Alamo said, "Hey, Susan Alamo is going to raise from the dead," and after 6 months of praying over her body like we did, she didn't raise, that was a big red flag. And then as we progressed and I began to see the abuse of my best friends, I began to feel the darkness that a lot of the adults who came to the church said they felt before they joined. So it was like there was like this reverse thing happening where I should have been getting closer to God or this idea of God. Instead, I was being pulled further and further away by the abuses, by the lies. And until I got to when I got to 17, I was like, no, I know the truth, and it's not what these guys are saying, because I can compare it to the Bible, which, you know, it's not an objective truth, but in that little cult world, it's all I had to compare it to.
We're going to learn more about how you did it and what your life is like today, but I want to talk a little bit about the cult that you were in and that became such an important part of your life so early on. Tell everybody what the Alamo Christian Foundation was publicly purporting and what the high-level beliefs of the group were.
Yeah, so publicly, we were promoting an end-time, non-denominational, fundamentalist belief system that Jesus Christ was going to come back to earth any moment, and that if you weren't right with God, if you weren't saved in our organization, in our organization alone, you would end up in hell. You would burn there forever. And that was it. That's what we promoted. We believed we had to go and save the whole world.
I always find this so interesting. And I am a believer in Christianity. I have been all of my life, and I've gone through periods of time where I've had to test and try that and really develop my testimony of God and Christ. And I always wondered when I looked at these kind of ideologies, how any leader could purport that a loving God would have such stringent rules for his children, that this is the only way, and that if you haven't ever heard of it, sorry, it didn't work out for you.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point to look at, because as groups get larger and larger, they need more punitive measures to control the groups. That's the case for most organizations. But if you do take your eye off the ball of what Jesus truly preached, which was the kingdom of heaven is at hand, it's here, and to love thy neighbor as thyself, that is the whole world. If you're not, and then to kind of subvert the meaning of love to beatings and forced fastings and all a whole slew of manipulative approaches, it just bastardizes that the faith. It's like this parasite that's attached itself to true loving message that Jesus preached. So yeah, it's a phenomenon that I think is happening in more and more religious organizations. You know, they need to use fear. And it is a sad thing. It's very sad.
It's interesting. I had this discussion with Phil McGraw, Dr. Phil, I remember him saying to me that his research has showed that at any given time, there are 6,000 plus cults operating on the planet. I've heard that number higher. I've heard that maybe it's a little less. I don't know. But there's a bucket load of cults, and I'm always interested in the evolution of these organizations. Can you help us better understand what the purpose of the group was in the early stages? And then we're going to talk a little bit about the evolution.
Yeah, so if you can think of the setting, so this is in the late 60s, early 70s, 1970s, and there was a big movement of people who wanted to kind of break away from the traditional society, you know, working 9 to 5, picket fence, that kind of thing. And, you know, with the war in Vietnam, people wanting, you know, the peace movement, there were civil rights movements, a lot of people were seeking change. And so this organization came in and said, "Hey, we have the change that you actually need. And it's through Jesus Christ. It's through love. It's through compassion and sharing and being your brother's keeper, looking out for your fellow citizen. And that's kind of like the kernel of the message. That's what we were really trying to do. At least when I, the way I look at this organization, you have the cult leaders, you have kind of this inner circle, and you have most of the followers underneath them. Most of the followers were doing kind acts every day. Day to day, they were looking out for each other. We made food boxes. We got donations, and we clothed the naked. We housed the homeless. We fed the hungry. We did the stuff Jesus was saying. So it's not like we weren't doing that. But as you ascend up the ladder, you start, and as time went on, one of the matriarchs, Susan Alamo, she passed away, and that message of love and peace began to get co-opted by Tony Alamo's message of fear and hate.
In reality, you believe, I hope I'm not putting words into your mouth, that Susan actually had maybe the higher law in her head and mind. And once she left the picture as part of this evolution and cankering that occurs in these organizations, then it started focusing more on the destructive leader and what's in it for me.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mike. Get this, on Susan Alamo's deathbed, she told Tony Alamo to disband the church because, quote, you will ruin their lives. It gives me goosebumps even thinking about it today, but that's what she told him on her deathbed, witnessed by several people. I made sure to put it in my book, but I can't drive that home enough. Susan Alamo was the spiritual leader. Tony Alamo had this quasi-marketing scam that he used to run, and he puffed himself up to be someone that he wasn't in his own narcissistic way. And when Susan died in 1982, by that time they had thousands of followers, millions of dollars, untold wealth, and there was no one to balance him.
Do you think that Tony ever believed the things they were preaching and teaching, or was he kind of going along because he saw there was a money train attached to it?
I know he went along because of the money. So as a child growing up in the mansion with him, there was a bathroom in their bedroom, and he had a Bible sitting on a toilet that he always used on the back part of it, set to the same pages every day. Dust used to build up on him. When the cleaners came in, they dust that off. And then he would go into church saying, I'm so godly, I even read the Bible on the toilet. Well, that's a lie. He wasn't doing that. That, like, I saw that, like, little evidence, like, you know, he's lying. And then when you look at how he began marrying young girls, do you know about this? As young as 8 years old, 12-year-old. It's so sick. I left before that was happening, but he began to use the Bible to justify rape and like horrible violence against women and of course against boys. I mean, we were always getting beaten and stuff like that. But he was a megalomaniac. I mean, he never healed from any narcissism that he developed as a child.
This is terrible, and you and I are going to do a book swap with your book and my book on Deceived, where children at that age were sexually assaulted as part of the cult that I was successful in tearing apart and tearing down. In that cult, even children as young as 2 were being sexually assaulted by adults in the group, but it really ramped up once the children were 8 to that prepubescent kind of range of age, and things really got out of hand. But you escaped this group when you were 17 years old. How on earth did you pull that off? I know that the group was going through kind of some, I hate to use the word political pressure, but some public pressure maybe at the time. And there were some criminal allegations going on early on, and the group kind of spread you all out, but maybe I've got that wrong. So you better tell the story.
You're good. That's a good description. But basically, after Susan Alamo died in 82, we were all told that she was going to raise from the dead. We prayed over her body for 6 months straight, day in and day out, all night long. We It was just crazy. She never raised from the dead. For me, that was like a first. At 7 years old, I realized, hey, you know, he's lying. He's a false prophet. But I was only seven. And so other things began to happen as I got older that didn't line up with the teachings of the Bible. And when that happened, I kind of turned my back against Tony, and I began to lie to him. I began to do anything I could to distance myself from him. And basically, like you said, the group got disbanded. The IRS came in and seized our property in 1991. And there was abuse claims that had come out of physical beatings of a child named Justin Miller. He had received like about 170 swats on his back and on his butt, to the point where he was bloody. And his dad, Terry Miller, came in and with the help of the IRS, ATF, they disbanded and seized all the assets of the organization. So we were spread to the wind. There was a huge exodus. We all left our community, and we had to go live in the world, as we called it, with our families or any other place we could manage to live.
Now I want to pause on that and hold you there for just a second, because that gave me a flashback to your documentary that I watched. It seems to me like, and did you actually have to witness some of those beatings? And I remember at one point, I felt like I was watching a spy show, by the way, Benjamin, because there was a moment when a key member of the organization went to Tony and said he had questions about your loyalty, and you were able to flip it on him and say, no, he's the guy you need to worry about. Tell that experience, but then again, answer whether you had to witness those beatings of other children.
Yeah, Mike, and it's something that still I work with in trauma therapy still today from witnessing the beatings. The beatings got progressively worse. It started just as like you'd get paddled for something, and then you were strapped down to a couch, and then before you knew it, they were holding a spread eagle in the air, four men, one on each limb, while a fifth man beat us with the paddle. And one of my friends got 100 swats in front of me. And at 40, his eyes rolled back. He passed out. But we witnessed it. I remember the screams and the cries and the terror that that the girls were feeling. These poor girls were like whipped, like horribly, for holding hands with somebody or passing a note in class. And so on one of those occasions, one of these adults went to go tell on me and say, hey, Benji was doing some of this stuff. And after seeing those beatings, I was like, no way, it wasn't me. Instead, I lied. I protected myself and said, no, it was him who gave me, basically, our science books had all the anatomy of women and men blotted out because I was not of the Lord. And a friend of mine and I stole the teacher's edition, which had all the anatomy. And because I wanted to see what was going on in the body. Like I just wanted information. So we steal it, we go to the bathroom, and he catches us. And we made a deal at that day. He wouldn't tell on me, and I wouldn't tell that he didn't blot out all the anatomy on his version, which would have got him in a lot of trouble. So that's what happened. He went and told Tony, hey, Benji and this other boy were looking at the anatomy of a girl. And I said, no, he gave us the book. So Tony believed me, and the boy confirmed my story because he didn't want to get beaten. And unfortunately, that teacher got beaten pretty bad. I've since apologized to that man, and we joke about it now because he's out. He sees what happened. But yeah, there was forced manipulation. I had to survive somehow. And that's all I knew what to do.
You got out at 17 years old. How did that happen? And where did you end up in this big mass exodus that was going on?
Right. So first the exodus happened. And when the exodus happened, I went and lived in New York with an adopted family that I was living with. And one of the things we were told was that the ground would open up and swallow us alive if we ever left the property. And so I literally at 16, when we were in New York, the asphalt at one of the homes, it had little cracks on it, you know, bubble up during the heat, during the summer. And I thought, that's it. So I'd walk on the grass or I'd jump over the cracks. And eventually some kids saw me doing it and they thought it was a game. And when I told them, hey, I'm afraid I'm going to go to hell if this, they started laughing. And it was just like a big wake up moment for me. So I realized it was a lie because the ground wasn't opening up and swallowing me. And so in my mind, I'm looking for like evidence. Show me a sign of what you're saying is true. And when that didn't happen, it just solidified my position against this cult leader who was my father for a long time, my dad. And I basically began searching for my own biological mother and father who had, for different reasons, left me in that place.
And you found your mother. What was that experience like?
Yeah. So in order to find her, I went through all these files that were in this office that I was managing at night. And I found a picture of her, and like I saw my name on a birth certificate for the first time. And I began to realize I was somebody else. I was this person on paper that didn't match up with this world they were talking about. And so finding her was, it was like being born again. I hate to use that word, but I had a new life, a new opportunity, a new window that I could kind of look forward to. And I had to plan slowly and methodically, so no one knew what I was doing after I found out she was alive. So my whole life, I believed she was dead. And then I essentially found out she was alive through another family member who was out. And then I also found my father, and he wired me money, he wired me a prepaid ticket at the airport. So I escaped with people following me to the airport and trying to grab me before I got onto the tarmac of the airplane. Yeah, it is. It's just a wild, wild little world, you know, in which people live.
Folks, I'm speaking with Benjamin Risha, former member of the Alamo Christian Foundation, a group headed by Tony Alamo. Benjamin escaped the cult at 17. This is a guy who went on to college, served in the military, traveled the world. He's appeared on Dr. Oz, The Today Show, Sundance TV, Investigate Discovery, and in People Magazine. We're going to continue to dig in to his thoughts on cults, religion, and the Alamo Christian Foundation. But Benjamin, I wanted you to talk a little bit about, after you met your parents, you kind of had this growing period. You've gone through a ton of stuff. I just mentioned some of that. Talk a little bit about college, about learning several languages, about joining the army. I mean, you didn't let moss grow under your feet, brother.
When I got out, it was a culture shock. Okay. I didn't know why I was angry, but I was angry all the time. Basically there was a disconnect between the world I thought that existed and what was actually happening. And my interactions with children my age, kids my age in high school, often turned into contentious arguments because I didn't understand their language. English I understand, but what they talked about, how they talked about things, I had no points of view. So I didn't even know the difference between dating, going out, seeing somebody. I didn't understand the basics of social life. And of course, this was before social media and stuff. And so I used to tell people I was from New York because I had an attitude. I didn't know what else to say. I couldn't explain to them that I went to a cult or I grew up in a cult. So when I got out, I actually got kicked out of high school for a teacher put his arm on my shoulder after I said shit in line in a public in the cafeteria, and he told me you can't say that. I didn't know who he was, and he was in back of me, and he touched my shoulder, and I just went. And I pinned him to the ground. They kicked me out. They're like, we can't have you doing that. And my mom was like, you need to go to the military. You need to get some discipline. But after I got out of I went to the Army Reserves. And because all my high school records were locked up in the cult. I didn't have any records to graduate high school. I got my GED. And I went back to college after I got out because I had the GI Bill and I failed. Failed horribly. All Fs and Ds. I was partying. I did drugs. I drank. You name it. I wanted to try it because I was just trying to bond, find who I could be friends with. And unfortunately, the party scene in California, at least in the 90s, it felt like it was just a place for me to land. I knew I wouldn't stay there. I knew because in the cult, all of the members were former, they claimed to be former drug addicts. And they talked about that. They talked about the world, how horrible it was being that person. So I always had my eye on understanding the world. That's all I wanted to do. Just wanted to understand what was going on in the world. And so, long story short, I failed. And then I wanted to make money, an insurance company, at which I applied for, recommended I start studying self-help books. So Stephen Covey, you know, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, things like that I began to read in order to have my own affect presentable as a salesperson. I got my insurance license. I sold insurance, mutual funds through the company. And then a client of mine said, "Hey, what is your degree?" And I didn't have one. And he recommended I go back to school. So I went back to, I went to a junior college. This time I wasn't partying. I got that out of my system and I started getting A's. I started just, I read everything and made honor roll, and then eventually transferred to a 4-year school where I got a degree in history, and had almost several other bachelor's degrees in sociology, religious studies, and philosophy. And the world was becoming my oyster. You know, I was just, I was absorbing everything, anything that came in. In the process, I went to Israel. I found out I had Jewish roots. I studied Hebrew. I studied Arabic. Came back and studied Spanish. Went on to work at a large aerospace company where I, you know, I was in an engineering kind of function, software engineer in test. I became a tester, somebody who, you know, and I made my way through the organization and did very, very well for myself. It's been 30 something years, but it took a while. Yeah, in focus, hard work, in really also at the same time going on with that, I was also in therapy. So talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, a therapy called EMDR. I started trying different modalities to kind of heal myself. And as I healed, I noticed the world became a better place. Like I understood it. And understanding is critical to, I think, functioning in any environment. And as I began to understand and I was able to monitor myself and control myself and work with my emotions and my feelings, all the things that we weren't allowed to do in the church, my life began and I began to ascend. And the book, I wrote the book and was able to talk to people about this without being triggered or, you know what I mean? Because it is a sensitive subject. There's a lot of trauma.
You know, folks, I'm talking to Benjamin Risha and we're talking about his time in the Tony Alamo cult. But before we continue, I want to pause for just a moment, Tony, and remind everybody about my book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. Deceived explores cult behavior, much like what we're talking about, cult dynamics. It chronicles my investigation and the ultimate takedown of a religious cult that had committed more than 4,000 sexual assaults against adult women and children. I eventually would lead a team of 60 officers as we raided the compound one summer early morning. In all, we arrested and convicted 12 predators. But to me, the real story and the reason for Deceived is to talk about the 32 child victims who rose above the abuse. Much like what we're hearing from Benjamin today. The book explores cult recruiting tactics and how seemingly intelligent people can be convinced to commit crime. You can get signed hardbound copies of Deceived at ProfilingEvil.com, or you can get paperback and ebook versions for a little bit less money at Amazon. So let's return to our discussion with Benjamin Risha. Hey, Benjamin, I guess the question I got at this point is, how big did the Alamo Foundation get?
As far as the size, I look at it as people and then property and land. So we had large swaths of property in the Saugus Mountains. Arkansas had about a 250 to 300 acre property. Tennessee, we had property in Tennessee, Texas, Florida, places in Canada. We had groups in Africa. We may not have been like living there, but we were proselytizing there and finding our recruits from there. And my estimate of the largest, maybe the number of recruits may have been anywhere from 5,000 to 7,000 at its peak. But eventually when Susan died, a lot of people left because they were following her. And so that's my estimate. Say on the compound in Arkansas, there was anywhere from 500 to 1500 people at any given time.
That's huge. And what a logistical challenge. Now, when Tony started marrying underage girls, you had been able to escape by then, but how on earth did this guy justify the sexual abuse that would follow?
So, and I'm gonna quote him. Tony Alamo called into Frank Sanchez on CNN. I forget his first name, but Sanchez interviewed him and asked the same question: how can you justify marrying an 8-year-old? And Tony Alamo said, "Mary, the mother of Jesus, was 12 when God impregnated her. Who the hell do you think you are telling me that I can't be with a 12-year-old? I mean, that is a link I can send you. You can listen to it. So first he began to justify polygamy. So it's like the slippery slope that he began to do. He justified polygamy as looking at, in the Old Testament, some of the kings of Israel had more than one wife, right? Solomon, 300 wives, 700 concubines. David had 4 wives, you know, and you can go on and on. Back 2,000 years ago, polygamy may have been just the way people lived, right? Anyways, I don't know. I don't want to speculate, but he looked at that and he said, they can have more than one wife because they're the man of God. So therefore, because I'm the man of God, I can have more than one wife. So he cemented that. And then he began his little downward slope even a little further by saying, well, if Mary was 12, then that means a 12-year-old, as long as they've reached puberty, they're a woman and they can begin to be married to men. And that's what he did. He found young girls in the families of the men and women that were loyal to him, and he would extract them from their families, put them in houses where only he could visit with the locks on the outside of the door so they couldn't leave. And he'd put 3 or 4, maybe 5 women in a house, another 4 or 5 women in another house. At the end of it all, he eventually had about 24 wives, the majority of which were under the age of 16 years old. And so it was like, you know, that analogy of boiling a frog. If you drop it in the water, he'll jump out. You slowly do it. That's the best way I can look at it. He was making frog soup out of these people by slowly turning up the heat and manipulating the texts of the Old Testament. That's the best way I can say it, you know.
I'm left speechless. It is so frustrating, and I feel like I've walked out of one cult and into the other. Would Susan Alamo have ever permitted that if she were still alive at the time he started making this transformation?
Absolutely not. She would have probably taken him to the hog farm and castrated that son of a bitch. Because that's Susan Alamo, while she was human and she was, you know, she had her own errors, I believe she truly believed to some extent in what she was saying. Once Tony Alamo dislocated my shoulder when I was a kid, he yanked me up by the arm, it popped out. He spanked me for something I didn't do, and Susan caught him, and Susan kicked him out of the house for the night, saying, if even one hair on this child's head is harmed, you will never walk again. She made statements like that. Now, Susan is a complicated figure in and of herself. She was married to Saul Lipowitz, who was the muscle behind Eddie Cohen, so a gangster, a Jewish gangster, and she kept her bed with very strong-minded men, but she often manipulated those men at the same time. She had great manipulation powers. So she, no way, she would have never allowed that. She, like I said, she would have had some, she would have taken him outside and had the brothers, the guys that we considered our brothers, she would have done something to that man. She would have messed him up. And, you know, I think justfully so. Sorry, it's a good question. It's a really good question, Mike.
Okay, so I want you to walk us through what a normal day in the Alamo Christian cult was like for you, Benjamin.
Okay, so an average day would be waking up probably around 6:30 to 7, you know, preparing yourself. The whole community would go eat breakfast in our large cafeteria. By 8 o'clock, we were in a church service where we would spend an hour giving our testimonies, singing, praying, or listening to a sermon by Tony. After that, the people who were working would go to their jobs. The children would go to school. And then by 5 o'clock, we'd eat dinner and then go into another service between 7 and 8 o'clock every day. So 2 services a day, 3 services on Sunday, because then we'd have our big Sunday church. We'd go down to Dyer, Arkansas, where we had an enormous church. And we would, we'd fellowship that way. Now, at night, though, while we were sleeping, Tony would often interrupt our sleep for something he called the reports list. So children or anyone who got put on report had to justify or explain what had happened during the day. So he used that technique. We were often sleep deprived by being up when he wanted us to be up, and we'd be shuttled to the mansion where he lived, and we'd have to account for our actions. And this was a practice ever since I was a little kid. Sleep deprivation, controlling the sleep, and then that's where the beatings would occur. If he decided, if he says God told him to do X, Y, and Z, then he would do that. It could have been a slap in the face. It could have been a beating, a forced fast, even separation from your own wife or husband, or children being taken away from their mother and father. And this was done at night, and it was a very effective way to keep us on our toes. If you're ever woken up in the middle of the night, you'll know, you know, you're not at your best. You're not thinking clear. That's when, yeah.
The ultimate, I mean, this is the nightmare of going to the principal's office on steroids, man. This is just incredible. And I know I remember reading about even him forcing you, the children, other children, to beat their own parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He would turn anybody, the divide and conquer statement. He was an expert at divide and conquer. He could divide a family. Yeah, I personally witnessed several times where children had to slap their mothers or slap their father or even take a paddle and beat their own parent. I wasn't able to tell all of that in the book clearly, but one story I think is enough to show the example.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it was so captivating for me and so disappointing and disgusting. I just can't imagine anyone having to endure that.
Oh, just one more thing. Excuse me. The other thing to add is that Tony, he worked us. He made us work. When I turned 10 years old, I was a man. You know, he recognized me as a man. He put me to work in the mechanic shop or planting trees or passing out tracks or in the big factory where we produce those rhinestone jackets. I'm not sure if you've seen those, but as a child, my weekends and my summers were filled with work, with labor. I never made a penny from that, ever. No one ever paid. And the man made millions and millions and millions of dollars off of it.
Yeah. I mean, how much would one of those sell to a superstar who would be seen on the red carpet wearing them?
Don King wears a USA jacket. I think that one's only, it's like $2,500, something like that. But, you know, some of them go to $3,000. So right around there, just for a jacket.
So what happened to Tony Alamo and what happened to the cult?
In the end, Tony Alamo was arrested and charged with 10 counts of transporting minors across state lines for the purposes of sex. So he was arrested for that, and he was put in prison for that. And then he eventually died. He died of sepsis in 2017. But the organization lived on. The models, I'm actually considering making a movie or writing a book called The Alamo Scams, because they had hundreds of different ways to scam people out of their money, and that's going on today. And so there's like I said originally, there's the leader, the cults, this inner circle. That inner circle is alive still, and they function out of various states. They have properties where they meet and, you know, this, you know, work on still being Alamos, as they call themselves.
It just struck me. I've been saying Alamo. I know that you say it from time to time about the organization, but you also call Tony Alamo the name Alamo. Is it interchangeable, or what? What's the deal there?
You mean the name, like Alamo versus Alamo?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Some people say Alamo. Some people say Alamo.
Potato, potato.
Yeah, potato, potato. Tomato, okay. Tomato.
All right. Hey, well, you have gone on to write a fascinating book called The Son of Seven Mothers. Tell everybody about the book. What motivated you to write? And then, most importantly, where people can order copies.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Initially, I found when I got out and people would ask me who I was, where I grew up, I would tell them my story, and they all said, you should write a book. Literally, probably hundreds, possibly thousands of people. So that's what started it as, you should write a book. And then as I began to get into it and study cults and their manipulation techniques and what life was like, I realized showing that I survived it and I've kind of come around as a different person and I've come through it, I wanted to give hope to people. That's really like in my heart of hearts what I wanted to do. I wanted to show people, hey, look, this happened to me, but look at what I've done. I wanted to write a second book showing how I went through therapy and how studying and travel, how those things kind of lifted me up and pulled me out of that dark place that I used to be in. So that's really why I wrote it. I think it's a captivating story, and people can read and they like sad stories because they can relate to it. We've all got sadness in our lives, and I think we always want to see the hero, the protagonist, come out of it okay, a different person, but stronger and better. So that's what I was kind of writing it for. It's on Amazon, you know, it's on Kindle, Audible, you can get paperback through Amazon, and Wild Blue Press is the publisher.
So Benjamin, I know that many of our listeners are going to wonder about the possibility of getting a signed copy of your book. Is there a way that they could reach out to you, maybe through your website or something, and express interest, hopefully pay a little more for that signature and have you mail it to them direct?
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. If they reach out to me, we can chat. I have a link to contact me on my website. So if they write me an email, we can work out something privately.
Great. So folks, we're going to put links to the book. You can get it at Amazon, or you can go to BenjaminRisha.com, and the information will be in the links down below. But make sure that you do that. Benjamin, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the podcast today. I want to give you the final word before I wrap up with a little business. Is there anything you'd like people to know about you, your experience, or for them personally, if they're facing the challenge of a loved one in a cult, or they themselves are in a cult and they're wondering how to get out?
Ooh, that's a big question. So what I would say, if you have family members that are in a cult, don't push against them. Just let them know that you love them, that you're there for them. And when they turn the corner and want to escape, chances are they'll remember your kindness. And they'll reach out to you. I think that may be one of the most effective ways to get to be and have someone that's in a manipulative organization. The only other thing I would say is that I know in today's world we are polarized by, at least in America, by our two different parties, and it kind of feels like we're in cults of our own. I would just want to reach out and just say, hey, remember we're all Americans, we're all suffering, and let's try to find common ground instead of reinforcing and entrenching ourselves in political divisions. We need to be united as people and as a country in order to succeed and have the world that we all want. That's about it.
Thanks a lot, Benjamin. And I'm just going to add to that, since I work in a global organization and I travel the world on a regular basis, and I would just extend that beautiful thought to beyond the borders of the United States, and that we as a family are a worldwide family. And this business of being mean or controlling or destructive has got to end.
Spot on, Mike. Amen to that, man.
Well, folks, these cases are disturbing. If you know somebody who's being victimized by destructive behaviors, or if you yourself are, please know that there's help available. There are resources and experts online. People like Dr. Yanya Lalik or Rick Ross, my dear friends, they spend their time helping people who are involved in cults. Now, whether it's for a former member who's dealing with the stress of entering society after fleeing a cult, or for a family member that's just looking for advice, or simply needing to know, as Benjamin said, that you love them and that you're non-judgmental, it's available for you. I'm going to be watching for all your comments down below on this episode. I hope you'll weigh in on your thoughts, feelings, and your emotions. Make sure you're taking time to review everyone else's comments and respond to them, because together we really do have a pretty neat way of looking and answering many of those questions. If you like this episode, click that like and subscribe button and make sure you're sharing our channel in your personal networks. And remember that you can always subscribe to Profiling Evil Podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. And if you are interested in supporting our efforts here at Profiling Evil, consider joining our channel memberships. Really helpful. My personal favorite is the Profiling Evil Academy, where you get to learn more about the criminal investigative process and the profiling process. Make sure you're following us on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And thanks again for all your support. We'll see you all soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.